And now, for our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents Rogue Angel by Alex Archer. Rogue Angel number 22, The Spirit Banner. Narrated by Nanette Savard, with performances by Colleen Delaney, Eric Messner, Jeff Allen, David Coyne, Danny Gavigan, Tony Nam, Mort Shelby, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, James Lewis, and Tim Getman.
Father Michael Curran, Special Vatican Envoy from His Holiness the Pope Innocent IV to the people of the Felt Walls, stared at the waves of oncoming riders and did what he could to keep the fear from showing on his face. Not that there wasn't good reason to be afraid. They were at least 3 days' hard ride from Karakoram, where Gayuk, the grandson of Genghis Khan and the current ruler of the Mongol Empire, held court over his subjects. In the years since the death of the great Khan, the empire had fractured. More and more tribes were returning to the old ways, fighting and competing against one another. The Naimans were one such group, and Curran's party was deep in a contested area that the Naimans claimed as their own. To make matters even worse, the honor guard that Gayuk had sent with Curran for this trip into the Hentin Nuru Mountains numbered less than 30 men, while the Naiman warriors currently charging their position appeared to number in the hundreds. As the enemy swept forward, Curran could see that each man stood high in the stirrups, guiding his mountain pony with his knees, leaving his hands free to use his bow with the unerring accuracy that had made the Mongol army so feared. The priest no longer had to wonder what hell might sound like. Now he knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt. The Naimans had caught the small group in the open, crossing a wide valley between two separate mountain peaks, leaving them with few places to run and little to use as cover of any sort. Curran had to admit to himself that it was a marvelous piece of strategic planning. Volk, their group's leader, had been too confident in his belief that no one would dare to attack a party under Gayuk's protection. But the harsh winter and the lure of overwhelming odds had apparently filled the enemy with daring. Having been forced into a desperate move, it now seemed that this group of raiders was determined to make certain that no survivors were left behind to report their audacity to the ruling Khan.
Fire!
As one, the soldiers around him wheeled about and sent their sturdy ponies charging for the mountain pass they'd emerged from a half hour before. One of the warriors snatched the reins of Curran's horse out of his hands as he thundered by, forcing him to follow suit. As they raced away, Curran fought to remember the man's name.
Tamaton? Tankayuk? Tamarak!
Tamarak was ordered by the Khan himself to personally see to the safety of the envoy. Curran had resented it at first, but now he was thankful to have the man at his side. Curran knew that if they could reach the pass in front of them, they could lose their pursuers in the passage across the mountains or take shelter in the many caves lining the passage walls. If they could hold off until dark, they might then be able to sneak across the valley without the Naimans being the wiser. Their horses thundered on through the snow while the enemy closed inexorably from behind. After a time, it was obvious to everyone that they were not going to make it, and the small entourage turned to fight. As the enemy closed the distance, they split ranks, sending half of their forces sweeping to the left while the remainder went right. From out of those ranks, the arrows came again. Kong watched Bolt topple from the saddle, with more than a dozen black shafts jutting from his body. In moments, the enemy had effectively stripped the small band of its most experienced leaders. If someone didn't do something soon, they were all going to die. Apparently, the men around him felt the same way, for the troops spurred their horses and charged the enemy. Curran's horse followed suit. The Jesuit was about to meet the enemy, whether he wanted to or not.
Lord, protect your humble servant.
The priest drew his sword and went to meet his death. The two groups slammed together with thunderous force. Curran found himself striking out at anything within reach, fighting for his life. For just a moment, Curran thought they might win. Then a heavily nailed fist smashed into Curran's face. He struck the ground hard and lay unmoving, the wind knocked out of him. Curran felt a stabbing pain in his left leg as darkness swept over him. Curran was surprised to regain consciousness sometime later. He passed out again from the pain. The second time he regained consciousness, the cold had dulled the pain to a minor roar, and he was actually able to open his eyes. He immediately wished he hadn't. The dead covered the ground in front of him and as far as he could see on either side. After stripping the bodies of anything of value, the Nymans had left them where they had fallen. Now their eyes stared unseeing, and their blood stained the snow in thick patches of crimson black. The bodies of his companions mingled with the corpses of their horses. Curran shifted his position. A lance of pain shot up from his left leg, and his head spun. He fought against the darkness, knowing that if he succumbed, he'd most likely freeze to death. When the dizziness receded, he looked down at his leg. He turned away. The dark shaft of an arrow jutted up from his thigh, and his own blood stained the snow. He couldn't ignore it, though. If he did, he would bleed to death. Steeling himself, he looked down at his leg again. The arrow had hit him high on the back of the thigh, and had gone all the way through at an angle, exiting about an inch above the knee. The exposed arrowhead was barbed. The other end of the shaft was feathered. He was going to have to break off one side or the other, and then pull the rest of it through.
Why bother?
Even if he could get the shaft out and stop the bleeding, there was no way he could travel in his condition. And if nightfall caught him here on the plain, he was sure to freeze to death. It seemed God had saved him from a quick, sure death, only to sentence him to a long, lingering one. But Curran was not the type to go down without a fight. The wind was picking up, and the snowfall had started anew. If he didn't do something immediately, he wasn't going to have the strength left to try anything at all. He tore several strips of cloth off the shirt of a nearby corpse, folding some a few times to create makeshift compresses, and laying the others out where he could reach them without difficulty. He rolled partially on his side, exposing the feathered end of the arrow. Taking it in his left hand, he gripped his thigh tightly with his right, holding it steady. Breaking the arrow had started the wound bleeding again. With shaking hands, he stuffed several of the compresses against the open wound and then tied it off with one of the strips. The pain made it difficult to concentrate, but he pushed through it. Gingerly placing his leg flat on the ground, he took hold of the tip of the arrow, wrapping his fingers around the barbed edges to give him more leverage. He gritted his teeth and pulled. With more than a bit of resistance, the rest of the shaft slid free. He tossed the broken shaft of the arrow aside, packed the wound with some snow and the rest of the compresses to stop the bleeding, then tied the whole thing off just as he had the entry point. When he was finished, he slumped on the ground, sweating, exhausted, and in considerable pain. After some time, he didn't know how long, the pain receded to a manageable level. He pushed himself back up into a sitting position and took a look at his handiwork. Blood had dried around the edges of the makeshift bandages, but it looked as if the wound had stopped bleeding.
Maybe I'm going to make it after all.
Curran slowly turned his head, not wanting to jostle his injured leg, but at the same time afraid of what he might see. To his vast surprise, the horse he'd been riding stood a few feet away, rooting through a partially opened saddlebag for something to eat.
Thank you, Lord.
The short-legged, shaggy beast had seen its fair share of death and was unmoved by it. Losing interest in the saddlebag at its feet, it caught sight of Curran and trotted over, looking to be fed.
Good boy.
The priest petted its nose with one hand while grabbing onto the straps of the saddlebags it still wore with the other. Using the straps for support, he hauled himself upright. It took several tries, but at last he was standing on one leg, his arms wrapped around the horse's neck to keep from falling. He rested in that position for a moment, praying the horse wouldn't make any sudden moves and dump him back down on the snow. When he'd caught his breath again, he reached for the pack still hanging around the horse's hindquarters, right where he'd loaded it early that morning. Working slowly and carefully to limit jarring his injured leg any more than necessary, he untied the drawstrings of the pack and withdrew the ceremonial robe he'd worn when appearing for his audience with the Khan in Karakoram. The material was quite thick, something he constantly complained about when wearing it, but now he was silently thankful. He slipped the material over his shivering form and slumped against his horse, already exhausted, and he hadn't even tried getting himself into the saddle. Curran straightened up, trying to see. Only the dead stared back at him. This time he saw the fingers of a nearby form twitch.
Hi! Hi, you! Can you hear me?
Until that moment, he hadn't even been aware of his tremendous thirst. He used a handful of snow to wet down his lips and throat before trying again.
Are you all right? Can you walk?
Curran had no choice. He was going to have to go over to the injured man and take a look. He supported his weight on the horse and got it moving slowly in the direction he wanted, hopping along on his good leg.
Oh, boy!
When Curran was close enough, he pulled the horse to a stop and dropped down in the snow next to the wounded man. He rolled the body over and discovered that it was the man who had saved him earlier, Tamarack. A sword blade had taken a bite out of the left side of his head, and two black arrows jutted from deep in his stomach. Curran had no way of removing them. The barbs were embedded. The best he could do was to make Tamarack as comfortable as possible and to stay with him until the end. An end that could come faster than either of them wanted if they didn't find some shelter and protection from the cold. Curran dragged the other man closer to the horse, where, to his surprise, the animal got down on its knees, allowing Curran to haul both himself and Tamarack's unconscious form onto the horse's back. The beast climbed to its feet, and for the first time since the Nyman war party had been sighted, Curran felt optimistic about his chances for survival. As if in answer, the wind swirled around him, and the falling snow began to thicken. The storm was here to stay, apparently. Curran took a moment to get his bearings, turned the horse about, and headed for the pass. One of the caves in the rocks would provide shelter from the storm. He'd worry about how to get back to Karakoram in the morning. First, he had to survive the night. Several hours later, Curran sat in a cave that was deep enough to filter out the winds howling outside. There had been a few sticks lying just inside the entrance. He combined them with some of the extra clothing from his pack and made a small fire to keep them warm. It was still cold, though not as bad as it would have been had they been trapped outside. It would serve to keep them from freezing to death.
Oh, at least until the fuel runs out.
He quickly pushed the image away.
The Lord will provide. The Lord will provide. At least we won't starve to death.
Curran glanced at the corpse of his horse, where it lay just within the entrance tunnel. The poor beast had collapsed after carrying so much weight through the freezing cold weather without rest. Curran hadn't yet managed to get up the nerve to start carving up the carcass. He didn't mind eating horse flesh. He'd been forced to do so during other missionary journeys, and it hadn't been all that bad. But this horse had saved his life. It seemed disrespectful. Still, Curran had little desire to starve to death. The dead horse was proof of what they had endured to reach this point. The trail had been difficult to find without the Mongols to guide them. The ever-increasing fury of the storm had cut their already slow pace to a crawl, as did the times that Curran lost his grip and toppled off his patient mount. Thankfully, the horse had traveled this way before, and when he finally stopped trying to control it and just gave it its head, it took him where he wanted to go. With the help of the firelight, Curran had cleaned Tamarack's head wound and had broken off the jutting ends of the arrows to keep the wounded man from accidentally driving them deeper into his body. After that, there wasn't anything to do but wait. The snow had continued to fall, and the entrance to the cave was half covered from the heavy accumulation. Curran didn't mind, as it served to keep the heat from the fire trapped in the cave, warming him and his unconscious companion, while still allowing the smoke to escape. Unable to sleep, Curran took out his worn leather journal and began to write, recording the events of the past several days in as much detail as possible to ensure that there was some record of what had happened to him should he not make it back to Karakoram. He'd been doing the same thing since his mission had started many months before, and what had once been an annoying chore had turned into a soothing balm for his spirit. At the very least, it gave him something to think about other than the pain in his injured leg, he thought ruefully. It wasn't long before Tamarack, delirious with fever and pain, began raving aloud. At first, Curran ignored it, knowing there was little he could do for the man. But then something Tamarack said caught his attention, and he listened more carefully. What he heard amazed him. If it was true, he was being given the secret of the ages.
I really need a miracle now, Lord.
He turned to a clean page of his journal and began writing frantically, trying to get it all down just in case the good father decided to deliver on his request. Anya Creed was knee-deep in sacrificial victims when the shooting started. The first gunshot was easy enough for her to ignore. After all, the sound of isolated gunfire was relatively common at a dig site this deep in the jungle. Just last week, Martinez had found a 12-foot python in his bed and had fired off 4 shots before he managed to hit the thing. A few days before that, the cook, a guy by the name of Evans, had used his shotgun to drive off the howler monkeys he'd caught raiding the food larder. The monkey still managed to get away with the chocolate bars he'd been hoarding. For the past 3 weeks, Anya and the rest of the dig team had been carefully excavating the ruins discovered at Tiluamachi, about 150 miles outside of Mexico City. A recent earthquake had cut a swath through the jungle, knocking down trees and natural earth formations with equal abandon, exposing a set of long-forgotten ruins hidden in a narrow valley deep in the jungle. A scout for a local logging company had discovered the site and, thankfully, had enough respect and admiration of his heritage to report the location to the Bureau of Cultural Studies rather than selling that information on the black market. The Bureau wasted no time in assembling a team of experts, including Anya, asking them to come down and take a look at what they had found. The main dig site consisted of a large 3-story temple complex in the standard step pyramid formation, with several smaller buildings lining the east and west sides of the courtyard extending south from the base of the pyramid itself. A few hundred yards to the west of the main structures was the site's cenote, a deep, water-filled sinkhole that the Mayans considered a link to the rain gods, or Chaks. Sacrificial victims and precious objects had been tossed into the sacred well as offerings during the site's heyday, as a way of protecting the populace and bringing good fortune. To the dig team's delight, the earthquake that had uncovered the primary dig site had also drained the cenote, exposing its secrets to the light of the sun for the first time in centuries. Anya was down in the hole, as they had come to call it, erecting a grid made of nylon rope and stakes across the entire area. This would allow them to record the precise depth and location of every object they removed from the muck-covered bed at the bottom of the sinkhole. That information would then be fed into a 3D simulation program that would provide them with a computer model to work with in analyzing the artifacts. It was important work, which was one of the reasons Anya had volunteered to do it. Despite the ankle-deep puddles and stinking muck that covered the bottom of the cenote, from where she stood, she could see the skeletal remains of at least 5 different individuals, and more than a handful of ceremonial objects, such as knives, bowls, and statuettes. The items they recovered from the cenote would probably tell them more about daily life at the site than the ruins themselves. It was like a window into the past, one she looked forward to peering through. But right now, she needed to forget about the past and focus on the present. Something was seriously wrong.
¿Ves a alguien más?
No, él estaba solo.
Anya looked up toward the rim of the cenote, expecting to see Arturo, her partner for the afternoon, peering over the edge and frantically signaling for her to come up. But there was no sign of him.
¿Para qué es esta cuerda?
Did he run off? Go for help?
Thankfully, the rope she'd used to climb down into the cenote was still where they had left it, hanging against the interior wall. It was tied off at the top around a tree trunk. Anya could get herself out of the hole. She slogged over to the far wall, being careful not to step on any of the remains scattered about her feet, and took hold of the rope. Planting one foot against the interior wall of the cenote, she began to pull herself up hand over hand, walking her feet upward as she went. She hadn't gone more than a few steps up the wall when a shadow blotted out the light from the setting sun above. Anya looked up in time to see Arturo hurtling down toward her, his mouth open in a silent scream. She let go of the rope. Arturo's body missed her by mere inches. The bullet hole in the center of his forehead leaked a thin stream of blood into the muddy water where he lay. She knew whoever was up there was headed her way, either to see if Arturo had been alone or to be certain he was dead.
If they look in and catch me here...
Anya didn't need to finish the thought to know she was in deep trouble. She had only seconds to find a place to hide. Any moment now, someone was going to stick their head over the edge and see her. The chances of surviving for even a few minutes after that were slim to none. Without hesitation, she threw herself down into the water at her feet, burrowing into the mud and muck, trying to cover herself up as much as possible. She kept one ear turned to the side, listening.
¿Ves a alguien más ahí abajo?
No, ya te dije que estaba solo.
Bueno, asegúrate que está muerto.
Anya didn't move. She was unable to tell if they had left or not. A bullet suddenly thumped into Arturo's unmoving form, and it took all she had for Anya not to flinch.
Tira la cuerda abajo para que no pueda salir.
The rope she intended to use to reach the surface was thrown down a few moments later. Anya pulled herself out of the muck and gathered her startled wits. There were too many people in the camp above who needed her protection. Reflexively, she reached out and placed her fingertips on Arturo's throat. Of course he was dead, but she couldn't leave without being certain. Gently, she brushed the side of her palm down over his eyes, closing them, and then stood. A glance upward told her she was alone, and she suspected it would remain that way. There was no reason for the assailants, whoever they were, to examine the cenote a second time, unless they wanted to dredge the bottom for themselves. She figured that wasn't too bloody likely, given the pile of artifacts that the team had already unearthed, that were just sitting around in the research tent above. Anya wasn't about to let the lack of a rope hinder her either. Her colleagues were up above, friends who were clearly in trouble, and she'd go through hell and high water to get to them. The walls of the cenote were formed from limestone, and thanks to the constant erosion of the water that had filled the hole, were pockmarked throughout, providing all sorts of hand and footholds for those who knew how to use them. Anya was one of those people. She grabbed a hold and started climbing, being careful to pace herself, despite the urgency of the situation. With more than 100 feet of climbing in front of her, the last thing she needed was to cramp up. She was careful where she put her hands and feet, knowing that the pockets of eroded rock might still be damp or even full of water. Without a rope, one slip could be fatal. Reaching the top, Anya cautiously peeked over the lip of the cenote. She saw no one. As silent as a stalking cat, she rolled smoothly to her feet and slipped into the thick foliage of the nearby jungle. The sun had set during her ascent of the sinkhole, something for which Anya was thankful. The darkness would provide additional cover for her as she moved through the dense undergrowth in the direction of the dig's main encampment. She smelled him first. The thick odor of cheap cologne, unwashed human body, and hand-rolled cigarettes clashed with the humid scent of the jungle around her and gave him away about half a moment before she blundered directly into him. Anya froze in place, waiting for her peripheral vision to pick him out in the gathering darkness. He stood a few feet up the trail, his back to her. The rifle he carried was slung over his shoulder, while his hands were busy in front of his body. Taking a deep breath, she put her right hand into the otherwear and drew her sword. Incredibly strong and unsurprisingly deadly, the ancient broadsword had once belonged to Joan of Arc. But when Anya had reunited the last of its pieces, it had become mysteriously bound to her. She could summon it at will and release it back into the otherwear when it was no longer needed. Reversing it in her grip so that the blade hung downward, she approached on silent feet. Anya rolled him over, made sure he was unconscious, and then took a good look. The briefing they had received before arriving at the dig site had mentioned that members of a revolutionary group had been seen moving through the region. The rebel soldier was dressed in a faded set of old fatigue pants and a dirty t-shirt. A new green cap with the emblem of his group emblazoned on it lay close by. He carried an assault rifle, an AK-47 to be exact. But unlike the rest of his uniform, the weapon was new.
Someone somewhere is arming the troops.
Anya shrugged off the thought as soon as it came. Right now, her only concern was rescuing the rest of her team from this guy's buddies. Anya considered taking his weapon, but she felt better with her sword in hand. In the end, she ejected the submachine gun's magazine and shoved it into the cargo pocket of her pants, then jammed the muzzle of the weapon into the mud at her feet, blocking the barrel. She also took the time to peel off the man's shoelaces and used them to bind his hands and feet. Between the smack on the head and the bindings, he should be out of the fight for some time. Satisfied, she moved off into the darkness again, slowly continuing to make her way toward the wide clearing where they had set up their main encampment a few weeks earlier. The path ahead grew lighter, the glow coming from the portable lights strung up over the eating area outside the mess tent, and she knew she was close. As there were sure to be guards posted at the top of the pathway, and she didn't want to blunder into another one unexpectedly, she decided to slide off the path into the thicker foliage and approach at an oblique angle. When she came to the edge of the jungle, she stopped and peered out at the camp. Their tents had been grouped haphazardly, without any real plan or design. Portable lights had been strung up here and there on poles to illuminate the most commonly used paths and in front of about half of the tents. From where she crouched, Anya could see that she was to the right of the mess area and about halfway along the maze of tents. She could also see several soldiers moving through the camp. She counted 4 in all. They were stomping in and out of the tents, kicking aside piles of equipment and supplies, looking for anything of value. She could also hear someone moving around at the other end of the camp, where the larger mess tent and command center had been set up. She couldn't see who it was.
No matter. I'll find out soon enough.
First, though, she had to deal with the soldier in front of her. Anya waited until they were all either inside a tent or facing the other way, and then left the cover of the trees behind and ran in a crouch to the nearest tent that hadn't been searched yet. Using her sword, she cut a long slit into the rear panel and then squatted at its edge, waiting. It didn't take long. The rebel came into the tent as she expected he would, head down, eagerly anticipating another iPod, cell phone, or laptop computer to claim as his bounty. When he bent over to paw through a backpack someone had left open on a cot, Anya slipped through the hole in the back of the tent. She had almost reached his side when he straightened and turned.
Madre de Dios!
Before he could recover his wits, she jammed the point of her sword up under his chin.
Give me your gun.
Sí.
How many others are there?
5, plus the captain.
That meant she'd already taken care of the captain's only companion, since she'd counted 4 men looting the tents. Too bad for them that the odds were in her favor.
What are you doing here?
The soldier shrugged. Anya pushed the sword blade a bit harder, and a thin trickle of blood ran down the man's neck.
Don't mess with me. What are you here for?
We run. Run from the police. We see the tents, comprende? The capitán, he says we need food and money. And maybe you find gold in the hole, comprende?
Anya knew she didn't have much time left.
Give me your shirt and hat.
¿Qué?
Give me your shirt and your hat, now.
Once he had, she made him turn around and knocked him out with the butt of his own weapon.
2 down, 4 to go.
Releasing the sword back into the otherwear, she pulled his shirt on over her own muddy t-shirt and shoved her hair up under the hat. She only needed to pass for the other man until she was close enough to carry out her plan. In the dark, and with the soldiers feeling secure that they were not in any danger, it just might work. She stepped out of the tent, the soldier's rifle slung over her shoulder, and the hat pulled down low over her face. The other soldiers were several tents away, a long stretch of darkness between them and her. They saw her emerge from the tent, but didn't think anything of it. The one in the middle turned to her and gave a come on gesture with one hand.
Vámonos.
Anya waved to show she'd heard him, and then held her breath. This was the moment of truth. If they were going to notice something was wrong, it would most likely be now, while their attention was on her and they were addressing her directly. The soldier hesitated. Anya tensed. The soldier turned back to his companions, apparently satisfied with her response. They waited for her there in the center of the camp's main thoroughfare as she approached, their attention on one another and not on her. She kept her right hand down at her side, ready to snatch her sword out of the otherwear the moment she needed it. Thanks to the pool of light cast by one of the overhead lamps, Anya was able to approach quite close to them while remaining shrouded in shadow the entire time. The man who'd spoken to her earlier turned as she approached, his eyes widening in surprise as she passed from shadow into light. His hand fumbled for the gun at his side. By now, the other 2 men were catching on. Anya pulled her sword from the man's abdomen and spun, her elbow out. The 3rd man brought up his gun. The hand holding the gun dropped to the ground. The soldier opened his mouth to scream. Heart beating madly, thanks to the adrenaline coursing through her system, Anya took a few deep breaths to get herself under control. She collected the soldier's weapons and tossed them into the darkness, then stripped the belts from the bodies and used them to bind the hands and feet of the unconscious man. When she was ready, she picked up her rifle once more and headed toward the mess area on the other side of camp. As she drew closer, the captain's voice came to her clearly.
¿Dónde está el tesoro?
None of the hostages answered him. Anya knew that most of those working the dig spoke Spanish. Apparently, they were pretending otherwise. Good. The sudden attack hadn't completely rattled them.
Where is the treasure?
By now, Anya had reached the edge of the wide area that served as the camp's main meeting place. Floodlights set up in front of the mess tent allowed her to get a good look at the rebel leader. He was about her height, with that wiry look to him that told her not only would he be fast in a hand-to-hand fight, but that he'd have the strength to match his speed as well. A wide scar started beneath his right eye and curled down to the edge of his mouth. Unlike the other soldiers, he was only armed with a handgun that was currently pointed absently at the rest of the dig team, who were kneeling in a semicircle in front of him. He did not appear to be happy with the cooperation he was getting, but he was clearly distracted as well, glancing back repeatedly over his shoulder at the trailhead that led to the cenote. Anya smiled grimly to see his unease.
Sorry, buddy, but there won't be any help from that direction.
Anya knew she was going to have to use the gun this time, The sword would raise awkward questions. She strode out of the darkness and into the light, the automatic rifle in her hands pointed unerringly at the rebel commander.
Put down the gun.
He turned, the gun in his hand coming up slightly toward her. Anya didn't wait to see what he was going to do with it, but stitched a row of bullets across the dirt at his feet.
I said, put down the gun.
He didn't drop the weapon, but neither did he raise it any higher in her direction. Instead, he glanced behind her while trying to stall.
You are making a mistake, senorita. A very big mistake.
I don't think so. And you can stop looking over my shoulder. They aren't coming.
Pardon?
Your troops? They aren't coming.
But after a moment or two, he frowned. As more time passed and help still didn't arrive, Anya saw on his face the dawning realization that he was on his own.
Here it comes.
He snapped his arm up. Under Anya's supervision, the rebels were rounded up by the archaeologists and other camp staff. The ones who were still alive were bound hand and foot with the same ropes that they had used to tie up the dig team. They were placed under the lights by the mess tent, where they could be watched until help could arrive. The dead were laid out nearby. Anya caught more than one of her dig mates watching her when they thought she wasn't looking. After they saw what had been done to the soldiers, Anya didn't care. She'd done what she had to, given the circumstances. Her conscience was clear. When they were finished, everyone gathered in front of the mess tent, arguing about what they should do next. Anya had just managed to get everyone settled down so they could discuss things rationally when Evans, the cook, pointed back over Anya's shoulder.
Hey, look!
Anya turned to see multiple sets of headlights coming down the narrow dirt track that served as the only entrance to the camp. In a few minutes, the vehicles were close enough to be identified as American-made military Humvees, painted in green camouflage. As the trucks braked to a stop, armed soldiers in blue jumpsuits, black flak vests, and helmets poured out and took up defensive positions around the camp, while Anya stared open-mouthed in surprise. A short, muscular man in an officer's uniform climbed down from the passenger seat of the lead vehicle, looked at the rebel soldiers, all carefully bound and gagged, and then marched over to where Anya stood. He stared at her for a moment, his expression grim.
Who is in charge, please?
Anya had no idea who these men were. Her hand curled, ready to summon her sword, but she didn't draw it. Then, deciding that her friends and teammates had had enough for one night, Anya bit the bullet.
I am.
His grim expression broke into a toothy smile.
And my compliments to you, senorita. You and your people have saved me considerable time and energy in tracking down and detaining these dogs. Yeah, permit me. I am Comandante Enrique Hernandez of La Policía Mexicana, and we have been following this group for many days. Unfortunately, we lost them a few miles south of here. Then we intercepted an emergency radio signal from this camp, saying that it was under attack.
Well, I'm glad you did. That was lucky for us.
Yes, just as it was unlucky that these so-called rebels found your dig site. They may be dogs, but they are not fools. Artifacts are worth much money on the black market.
Surprisingly, Hernandez didn't ask many questions about what had happened to the rebels, or how a few archaeologists and graduate students had managed to overpower six soldiers armed with heavy weaponry. He seemed happy just to have the problem dealt with, and in so final a manner. Perhaps he felt he was better off not knowing. Either way, Anya wasn't going to complain. The last thing she wanted was more attention from the law enforcement community, in this country or any other. She'd certainly had her fair share of that lately.
Bueno, aseguren las armas y amarren los cuerpos arriba de los vehículos.
As the comandante began ordering his men to secure the weapons and pick up the bodies, Anya excused herself and went looking for a hose. She could stand the stench of the muck she was covered in for only so long.
They say that you single-handedly defeated the rebels. Is that true?
Anya used one hand to shield her eyes from the glare of the floodlights and looked toward the speaker. The newcomer was tall and good-looking, with dark curly hair and a 5 o'clock shadow that somehow made him look more carefully groomed than a clean shave would. His white shirt and tan suit hadn't picked up any red dust yet, which meant that he'd just arrived. He stood in a relaxed, easygoing manner, but something about him still set her radar to tingling.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't believe everything you hear.
When she straightened back up, she found him still standing there, watching her.
Can I help you with something?
That would depend. Are you, by chance, Anya Creed?
That would depend. Who's asking?
Forgive me. My name is Mason Jones, though my friends call me Mason. I'm here with an invitation from my employer, John Davenport.
John Davenport?
Yes.
The John Davenport?
Is there some other John Davenport I should be aware of?
No. No, of course not.
Davenport was to Britain what Gates was to America, or Murdoch to Australia. All three were incredibly wealthy, but only Davenport had an active interest in ancient cultures and used his immense wealth to regularly sponsor major archaeological expeditions to all kinds of unusual locales. Anya was suddenly acutely aware of how she must look, her hair still full of the muck from the bottom of the cenote, and her t-shirt and pants now wet from the hose.
What can I do for Mr. Davenport?
Jones reached inside his suit jacket and came out with a cream-colored envelope. He handed it to her. The envelope was sealed with a dollop of red wax, in the middle of which had been pressed the Davenport Company logo. Inside was a note on a small white card. It was handwritten in a smooth, flowing script.
Dear Miss Creed, it would please me greatly if you would accept my invitation to dinner this evening at my home outside Mexico City in order to discuss a particular business proposal. Mason is authorized to provide anything you require, including transportation to and from the estate, and I am willing to pay you a consulting fee of $5,000 just to hear me out, no strings attached. At the very least, you can be assured of having an excellent meal. Sincerely, John Davenport.
Anya looked up from the note to find Mason waiting patiently for her answer. She thought about it for less than a minute.
Sure. Why not?
After checking in with the site coordinator to let him know she would be leaving, Anya changed into clean clothing, gathered what little gear she had from her tent, and returned to the main encampment to find Jones standing next to a newer model Land Rover. He opened the passenger door for her, stowed her bag in the back, and then climbed in behind the wheel. Mexico City was at the other end of a 3-hour drive down a poorly maintained dirt track, and Anya settled in for the trip, only to be surprised when Jones pulled off the main drag onto a side road that amounted to little more than a goat trail.
Mexico City is that way.
You are correct, Miss Creed.
Anya gave him a moment to explain further, but it quickly became clear he wasn't going to do so.
Then why on earth are we going this way?
Because this is where I left the helicopter.
Oh.
They bounded over a few potholes, skirted a fallen tree trunk, and emerged suddenly into a small clearing recently cut from the undergrowth. In the middle of the clearing sat a Bell Jet Ranger, its sleek black frame looking like some kind of giant insect in the midst of that primeval landscape.
Right. The helicopter. How silly of me.
This time, Jones couldn't keep a straight face and actually grinned. The flight didn't take long, and her companion turned out to be enjoyable company.
How do you like working in television?
You've seen the show?
Chasing History's Monsters wasn't for everyone. Every episode featured two or three different stories presented with a mix of facts and fiction. Being the scientist she was, Anya's role usually involved shooting down the more outrageous claims, especially those of a supernatural sort. Of course, using hard science to prove that things like vampires and werewolves didn't exist only gave the true believers more reason to shout cover-up and go on believing all the same.
I'm a regular fan. In fact, it was because of your work on the show that the boss decided to seek your advice.
Oh.
The idea of one of the world's richest men watching her show on a regular basis was just a bit weird. Anya couldn't quite wrap her head around it.
Maybe he was watching it for some other reason.
I have to tell you, though, I don't care much for that other host. Kristen? Kathy?
Christy. Christy Chatham.
Right. I mean, my lord, could they hire a bigger bimbo? She can't even string three coherent sentences together, and the wardrobe malfunctions became tiring after the first time or two. Do we really need one every other episode?
Jones was banking the chopper, paying attention to the controls rather than looking her way, and so he missed the expression of shock on her face, shock that quickly turned to delight.
Do they think every guy watching the show is a complete moron?
Yes.
Anya decided right then and there that she and Mason Jones were going to be very good friends.
Tell me more.
By the time he set the chopper down on the landing pad at Benito Juarez International Airport in Mexico City, about 40 minutes later, they were on a first-name basis. A car was waiting for them when they disembarked, a uniformed chauffeur standing beside the open door. Mason introduced Anya to the driver, whose name was Jose, and told her that Jose would take her to her hotel so that she could freshen up prior to her dinner with Davenport.
What about you?
Mason jerked his thumb over his shoulder at the helicopter behind them.
Someone has to put away the toys.
Satisfied that she was in good hands and things were proceeding the way they were supposed to, something she had learned the hard way not to take for granted, she climbed into the air-conditioned vehicle and let Jose drive her to where she needed to go. The hotel turned out to be the Four Seasons on the Paseo de la Reforma, or as the locals called it, Reforma, just a few blocks from Chapultepec Park. The hotel staff was expecting her, Jose obviously having called ahead, and she was quickly whisked away to a luxury suite on one of the hotel's upper floors. The porter who carried her bag upstairs and deposited it in the walk-in closet passed on the message that all gratuities had been taken care of and that the car would be back for her at 6. He shut the doors softly as he exited the room, leaving Anya to take in her posh surroundings. The suite consisted of a spacious living room area, complete with a wet bar, a flat-screen TV, a stereo and DVD player, all carefully arranged amid the couch and several armchairs. The bedroom contained a king-size bed and another television artfully mounted on the wall, as well as a walk-in closet and private dressing area. But it was the master bath, with its oversized soaking tub, that did it for her. Anya wasted no time in filling it with hot water and scented bath oil, then stripped off her dust-covered clothing and settled in to enjoy a long soak. When she had scrubbed away the last of the dirt and grime of the jungle, and her muscles had unknotted enough that she was again feeling human, she rose from the water and slipped into the thick terry cloth robe the hotel provided its guests. She sat in the dressing area and brushed out her long hair, then, noting it was almost 5:30, decided she had just enough time to get dressed for her meeting with Davenport. But when she stepped into the closet to retrieve her bag, she found a selection of quality clothing of different colors and styles hanging on the racks. A peek confirmed her suspicions. All of them were in her size. How Davenport had known that was beyond her. While she appreciated the thought and attention he had obviously put into this meeting, it also made her feel uneasy.
Just what does the man want? And why this show?
Anya didn't know, but there was one way to find out. She ran her fingers over the fabrics of the dresses hanging in the closet, admiring their cut and the feel of each garment, then turned away and pulled some clothes from her own bag. By the time the porter called up to tell her that her car was waiting, she was comfortably dressed in a pair of tan cargo pants, a white linen blouse, and her sturdy hiking shoes. She wasn't here to play dress-up for Davenport, and she hoped her choice of clothing would convey that message without making her seem ungrateful. She added a native bead necklace that highlighted her ambergreen eyes and decided it would have to do. With a last glance in the mirror, she headed for the elevator, her curiosity over being summoned to dinner by one of the richest men in the world nearly overwhelming her.